went down to Barcelona. Someone broke in my car. And I'll search the world over for my angel in black. Yeah, I'll search the world over. Or a Euro trash girl. Took the train down to Athens, and I slept in a fountain. Some Swiss junkie in Turin ripped me off on my cash. Yeah, I searched the world. My angel in black. Yeah, search the world over for a Euro trash girl. Euro trash girl. Euro trash girl.
Atop the hidden bunker in the Rocky Mountain, it's time for Downrange Radio and your host, Michael Bain.
Okay, welcome to our day late and a dollar short Downrange Radio. I, of course, am your host, Michael Bain. It is, of course, not Wednesday. It's not Wednesday, it's Thursday. Thursday. And of course, we all know what Thursday is. It's one of the most important days of the week. Yes, it's the day that Wicked Weasel, the Australian bikini company, updates their website with their constant bikini competition from women around the world. So we're all really keyed into Thursday morning, aren't we, guys? Aren't we? Anyway. Okay, I was on vacation. And so I decided it was really important to get a weekly podcast up and not miss one. So, hey, here I am. Here I am, your host Michael Bain, back in the saddle again with a golden oldie. And really, isn't it great to hear that? Isn't it great to hear a golden oldie like that? That is, of course, the classic Cracker doing Euro Trash Girl. I'd search the world over for my angel in black. Woof. Actually, the singles version of that song, which I'm sure you all know, or maybe you don't all know, it goes on for about 300 hours or something like that. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. But I played a little bit of it there, and I've got another golden oldie that you're really going to be happy to hear. I got that playing at the end of the show, and today's show is going to be a little abbreviated because, you know, it's Thursday. Come on, guys. Anyway, went to Santa Fe. Wonderful time. My sweetie and I went to Santa Fe. And if you get a chance to go, you should follow the Michael Bain School of, like, the Michael Bain Food Trail through Santa Fe, which includes the Shed. We've talked about that before, years and years ago. I think, actually, one of my first podcasts I did just after I'd gotten back from Santa Fe, back in, like, 2004, something like that. The Shed, which is the mother church of chili red sauce. Just superb. Get the blue cheese enchiladas with the red sauce on them. That is a classic there. Maria's, absolutely a wonderful, Maria's Mexican Grill, wonderful, wonderful Southwestern cooking restaurant. There you're going to get the world's greatest chili rellenos. And these are nothing at all like those wretched chili rellenos, those horrible deep fat fried all gummed up things that you usually get when you go to a Mex restaurant. Instead, these are just perfect. These are what chilies want to be when they grow up. Absolutely. And get that with green chili. It's hot. Yes, as a matter of fact, it is hot. Now, also, I'd like to, whenever I'm in Santa Fe, go by the Blue Corn Cafe, which is also a microbrewery. They make an excellent pilsner called Atomic Blonde. I like that pils a lot. And they also do a corn and chipotle soup. And that's a soup I love. I just absolutely love that soup. And be forewarned, if you're on the Michael Bain Food Trail in Santa Fe, be forewarned, the corn and chili soup at the Blue Corn Cafe is honest to goodness, accept no substitutes. We are not joking hot. It is a Pepto-Bismol drinking-inducing event. So I try to save it for a night where I don't have anything else planned when I drop these hot chilies on my sad and pathetic digestive tract. But you know, now I have no bacteria left. In 4 or 5 days, I have seared, I tell you, those bacteria out of my digestive tract. I am a healthy boy. So, and also lots of margaritas, which clear the head. I said on the blog, the Jimmy Buffett song, you know, trying to reason with the hurricane season, cleans me out and then I can go on. And boy, Santa Fe Hot Chilies will do that for you. Okay. What's new? I'll talk a little bit about Gun World in a minute, but I want to have a mini rant since we're going to have an abbreviated version of the show today, which, of course, is the audio podcast incarnation of Downrange Television, www.downrange.tv, powered by the Outdoor Channel, and brought to you by our fine sponsors, including Ruger, Para USA, Liberty Safes, and Tactical Solutions. I wanted to do a little mini rant, right? Small thing. But I note that our president went to Japan and bowed before the emperor. Did such a bow that even the Japanese thought it was a bit egregious, and they're big on this bowing thing. And before that, I note that our president has went to Saudi Arabia. You know, when he first took office, and he bowed to the head Saudi guy, head Saudi dude. I don't know what they call him over there, the Sheikh of Arabi, whatever. But the head Saudi guy, I'm sorry, Sheikh of Arabi, if I'm being, culturally confused, inconsistent, whatever. But anyway, the chief Saudi prince of the press, our president, also bowed to him. And it got me thinking about bowing in general. And I may have told you this story before, but hopefully we got lots more listeners now, so I thought I'd tell it again. And it's about bowing, so it's definitely apropos. When I was a baby journalist, for a newspaper in Florida, daily newspaper, and I was the hotshot feature writer. I was the young, blazing feature writer there. And I got a primo assignment one day. I believe the Prince of Wales. I'm not totally sure on English royalty, because as you know, I'm of Scots ancestry. So most of my ancestors spent a lot of time trying to kill English royalty. But I'm not really up on it, to tell you the truth. But I believe it was the Prince of Wales, and he was coming to this town, small town where I worked for the small town newspaper. And so the editor calls me, an editor-in-chief, who normally only call me in to tell me that my expenses were really screwed up. But the editor calls me in and he goes, you are getting the dream assignment. You are going to dinner with the Prince of Wales. And he's got an exclusive interview for you. You're going to go to a big, like a sort of a state, mini state dinner. And you're going to go and you're going to dress up and, you know, not look like your usual bum self, long hair, army jacket, blah, blah, second-rate scum reporter kid. But this is a primo assignment. This is a 1A above the fold, boy. This is good. And I said, oh, man, that's so super. I can't wait. And he introduces me to the representative of the Prince of Wales, who is talking to me about this and that. And then they say, and this is the person who is in charge of showing you the proper etiquette. We have an etiquette person here. Make sure I eat with the right fork. And there'll be like 80 forks and 10 spoons. And I need to know all those kind of things, which they generally don't teach you in Tennessee. Knife and fork, we're good with that, especially the knife part. But so in the course of this, I'm listening and I'm thinking, this is going to be real primo. I'm going to have, you know, essentially the whole front page of the paper. It's going to be a really big deal. And then we get to the etiquette person. We're taught, we get to the forks and the spoons and knives. And she said, I need to instruct you on how to bow. And I'm like, excuse me? And she goes, How to bow. The proper respect to be shown the prince, you know, heir to the throne of England. So, well, and I kind of laughed. I made a big joke about it. I thought, you know, I looked back at the editor and I said, you know, didn't we fight a revolution about, correct me if I'm wrong, even though I went to high school, you know, in junior high and elementary school in Tennessee, where we actually only studied Lee's Northern Campaign and things like that. We talked about that. But I said, I I remember vaguely we had a couple of days on the Revolutionary War, something about, you know, England, George, all this kind of thing. And he goes, "What are you talking about, Michael?" I said, "Well, I'm not sure about bowing." And the editor-in-chief said, "Shut up and listen." So I'm like, okay, you know, I'm a young guy. I shut up and I listen. And she goes, here's the proper etiquette. Now, here how you, as, you know, da-da-da, would bow to the prince. And I kind of stepped back again, and I said, "I realize this is really silly among all you adults, but I have a problem here. And my problem is that I will not bow to royalty. I am an American, and I don't bow." And there's a long silence in there, and the editor-in-chief finally goes, "This is a joke, right, Michael? This is a joke." And I'm like, no, it's not a joke. I have an issue here. And it's a philosophical issue. It's an issue of my heart. I won't bow to anyone. And so they all huddle together, and they pull me over, and essentially the editor-in-chief says, "Have you lost your frickin' mind? We give you this plum assignment, you know, you are a representative of us, and extension of that, you're a representative of the state of Florida, and you're a representative of the United States. For God's sakes, act like an adult." And I said, "I will not bow to an earthly king, period, period, period. Give the story to somebody who bows. I don't bow. I am an American, and I don't bow to foreign royalty." And, you know, essentially the editor-in-chief threw me out of the office, apologized, docked my pay, and basically, and I kind of moved down a notch in the hierarchy after that. But I you know, looking back on that, I can't see anything I did wrong. I don't bow. I am an American. I don't bow to foreign royalty. Along the way, I've met some really interesting foreign royalty. And every time I've met them, I've shook their hands and I've nodded and I've been gracious. And you know what? I've never bowed. Never bowed. I once took the president of a South American nation to a barbecue place in Memphis because nobody told me he was a famous president of a nation. He told me it was the best day he'd had in years. And I didn't bow to him either. I don't bow. Americans don't bow. Now, that's not the same as not showing respect. I would be happy to show respect to the Prince of Wales. I'd be happy to show respect to the Queen of England. I would be happy to show respect to the Chief Saudi, the Sheikh, the Chief Sheikh in Saudi Arabia. But I do not bow to foreign royalty. Strange. I guess maybe I'm traveling to the beat of a different drummer.
Like the shooting sports? Want to see the newest firearms before anyone else? Then there's only one place to be on Wednesday nights. Outdoor Channel, America's leader in outdoor TV.
And speaking of new guns, you have been to Downrange TV, right? www.downrange.tv to enter our various contests, which include for an FNAR 7.62 rifle. We're the only people giving one away. Also, a wonderful set of Ruger SAS Shingle Action Shooting Society Vaqueros. And as always, if you sign up for our forums and post once, become a member of our family, and we will enter your name twice in those drawings. And hey, go on the forums and ask how many forum people have won wonderful prizes from Downrange. So I mentioned the FNAR because there's a number of announcements from my pals at FNH who are sponsors on a Best Defense, and also make some fine guns. We all know that, darn. But anyway, there's going to be a 16-inch barrel version of the FNAR, which is really cool. We all know the FNAR is essentially a militarized Browning automatic rifle. Right? That's not the World War II 30-06 machine gun. That is the Browning hunting rifle, the Browning automatic rifle. And the FNAR is a militarized version of that, beefed up, 10-round, 20-round magazines available for it. And 16-inch barrel will be a tremendous asset. That's really good because it's a cool, fast-handling rifle, and the 16-inch barrel is definitely a plus. I haven't looked closely at the spec on it. If it doesn't have a muzzle brake and you get a 16-inch barreled FNAR, you need to put a good muzzle brake on it, period. A good muzzle brake helps a tremendous amount when you're talking about short-barreled 7.62 rifles. For example, the M1A SOCOM version, the 16-inch barrel, 16.5-inch, whatever, barrel version of the M1A, that is it has a superb muzzle brake on it and makes it a really easy gun to shoot. So anyway, that's cool. What else is coming? The FNH has announced that the civilian version of the SCAR Heavy, that is the 7.62 version of the FNH SCAR rifle that is now already in service with some units. And as I mentioned to you, I happened to actually run into one of the Army Ranger units that had SCARs. But that is now going to be available in the semi-auto civilian versions in 2010. You can expect that rifle to go for a pretty penny. Yes, indeedy, a pretty penny, because the demand will be very high for it. The demand. You know, I shot one. I thought it was the best shooting 7.62 rifle I'd ever shot, period, hands down. Flomp. But it's going to cost you a couple of dollars to get that rifle, especially until the pipeline starts filling up. A lot of talk about the fourth-gen Glock. I called up my Cherubs and Seraphim, you know, out there in Georgia, and we talked about the fourth-gen Glock. The fourth-gen Glock, fourth-generation Glock pistol, it's going to have some kind of replaceable backstrap. The reason for that is a lot of the military spec coming down now, and also from the larger police departments, law enforcement agencies, that spec is requiring some kind of adjustment for hand size. So that's why you see so many of these new polymer frame pistols that have a replaceable backstrap of some sort. You know, whether it's the F&H, whether it's the Smith & Wesson M&P, Ruger SR9, and coming up on the fourth generation Glocks, you'll see something that allows you to adjust that width for to adjust the grip a little bit for hand size. It will be textured. The texture of the frame is going to be somewhere between the current Glock frame, the current texture on the current Glock frame, and the super rough texture that is available. That super rough texture is a bear. If you've ever handled one of those guns, you could take it and slap it up against the wall, and I swear it would stick. It's a really rough, almost kind of beyond skateboard tape roughness on the super rough texture, which I would see more reason. If I was going to go to a Glock there, I would only want that rough texture under two conditions. One, if I was a competition shooter, because we've talked about that before, is that as a competition shooter, you want the gun to be in your hand dead bang, chonk. That's why we all used to have our guns checkered when I was shooting IDP, IPSC and IDPA. We would have our guns checkered in a pattern that Rob Latham, I think, coined this phrase, blood donor pattern, which is the checkering was so sharp it would bite into your hands, but it's like nailing the gun into your hands. The second situation I would want the extremely rough textured Glock grip was, say I was law enforcement in the Deep South, where it's wet, you know, Florida, Georgia, Alabama, along the border there. Or if I was a civilian and, you know, living in those areas where you got a lot of heavy moisture in the air. You know, I used to live in Florida where wood rust, where, you know, pieces of steel would mildew, you know, just before they rusted solid. So in those conditions where you're guaranteed wet hands, either from, you know, from the sweat or from the moisture in the air or a lot of rain, I can see that really rough textured grip that's now available on the 9mm and the 40 caliber Glocks to be a real plus. So fourth gen, they're going to be sticky, but not that sticky. Something on the recoil spring, some changes in the recoil spring. But in general, I mean, it's going to look like a Glock. I do like the replaceable backstrap. It allows you to set up a gun the way you want to set up a gun. And it's a big issue for law enforcement and military where you've got people with smaller hands. And you give them a great big fat grip. And it's a problem. It's going to be an issue. So watch for 4th Gen Glock. F&H pistols change in the 9mm and the 40 to bring them more into line with their 45, which I, as you know, I purchased an F&H 45 because I thought it was just a super gun. It's a big gun, heavy gun. But I liked it a lot. I liked the ergonomics of it a lot. I liked the way it shot, which was just superbly. My sweetie went through her first gun sight class with an F&H 9mm. I let her go through the gun safe and shoot as many as she could and choose the one she liked. She took the F&H 9, which has my name on the slide. And gone. It's amazing how those things happen. But so we're starting to see a lot of those things coming out, and I'm looking forward to SHOT. I mean, it's going to be a lot of fun. I've also been told by a couple of big companies that they can be telling me some stuff in December, but they can't be telling me this stuff now. I'm going to throw something out here, too, and this proves that I don't, you know, this has a potential of making me look like a complete idiot, or more than a complete idiot that I might normally look like. But there's rumors all over the internet of a Ruger 1911. And so I went to Ruger, and my contacts with Ruger are great, and said, "Is there a Ruger 1911? They go, "Absolutely not, Michael." They said, "You've been in the factory." They said, "You've walked around our factories, you know, North Carolina, and our factory, or not North Carolina, but in New Hampshire." Both begin with an M, have two words, caught me off guard. New Hampshire and in Prescott in Arizona. And they said, "Did you see 1911? They said, "At this late point in your career, you ought to know what a 1911 assembly line looks like." I said, "Well, I do." But what I was told, absolutely not, under no conditions, for no reason, period, that's it. There will not be a Ruger 1911 in the foreseeable future. So I'm going to tell you that, and I'm also going to tell you that that gives me the potential of looking like a complete and utter weenie on SHOT Show Mornings. So we'll see how that goes, but I wanted to throw it out there for you. So again, looking at an abbreviated version today, and every time I say that, I always go long. But hey, hang on, we're going to put in a plug here for our good friends at Crimson Trace. Now, as you know, if you saw it on Downrange, that's where we broke the story, of course. Crimson Trace Green Laser, available on their vertical foregrip for the AR-15 platform. Why a green laser? We talk about that on the Downrange. Talked about that a little bit on the blog. A little bit better visibility in daylight. You know, so a mission-specific laser. The drawbacks is it sucks power. Much more than a red laser. Much more complex to do than a red laser. They showed me how you have to set up that little laser diode for a green laser. Super deluxe complicated compared to the red laser. But it gives you an option, and there'll be a module. You already have the vertical foregrip for the AR-15 platform guns, or for any gun with a rail. With the Crimson Trace laser and white light, you'll be able to get a module to drop in for green laser if that's a mission-specific need for you. So here's a plug for Crimson Trace. Hang on, we'll be right back.
I've been on the local police force for 10 years now. I've stayed away from different gadgets and gimmicks that were supposed to improve my shooting. A few months ago, when I was at the range, another officer was using Crimson Trace laser grips. I have to say, I was pretty skeptical at first. Well, he let me shoot his gun, and I couldn't believe how fast and accurately I could hit the target, even in unconventional positions. At that point, I became a true believer and bought a set for myself. They were simple to install and easy to use. Crimson Trace laser grips are not a cure-all, but when my life depends on it, that red dot clearly identifies my point of aim, especially in low light conditions when most shootings occur. You could say it helps bad guys make informed decisions.
Get to your favorite gun shop and try a set today. Or contact Crimson Trace for a free catalog at the location of a dealer near you. Call 800-442-2406 or visit their website at crimsontrace.com.
Welcome back to our day late and dollar short version of Downrange Radio, powered by Outdoor Channel. I, of course, am your host, Michael Bain, and We're obliging to our fine sponsors, Ruger, makers of fine, fine rifles, pistols, shotguns, semi-autos, revolvers, Para USA, and their great LDA, light double action system, America's number one safe company, Liberty Safes, and, as always, our friends in Idaho, Tactical Solutions, makers of .22 caliber solutions for whatever gun you want to shoot. So, as I said today, a little bit of an abbreviated edition, but I wanted to get a show up this week. And, you know, I think what I want to spend the rest of the show talking about here a little bit is stopping power. Interesting thing. If you read the blog, if you go to the Michael Bain blog, and of course I haven't insulted you this week, but don't worry, you're on the list. It's a short week. I'll definitely get to you before Thanksgiving, before Turkey Day. But we were talking a little bit about Caleb over at Gun Nuts Media. He was talking about stopping power, looking at a lot of handgun stopping power, going, "Wow, you know, you got to aim." And I agree with that 100%. But one of the aspects of stopping power that I wanted to come back and talk about is expectation. And that's expectation on the part of the shooter and the shootee. And because I believe, and again, I could be wrong, Your mileage may vary, da-da-da, objects in the rearview mirror, et cetera, et cetera. I believe that the expectation on the part of both the person with the gun, the say a civilian in a legal self-defense situation, and on the part of the criminal, those their knowledge and expectations of firearms enters into how they will respond if they're shot. Now, one of the things I mentioned on the Michael Bain blog is back when I took Masaoub's LFI, Lethal Threat Institute 1 course, which has got to be 20, 25 years ago, and so long ago, I can barely remember it. I don't know if Mas can remember it at all. But one of the days in the LFI course, Mas showed people who were shot, autopsy photos, people who were shot, and discussed what happened after they were shot, which is, here's what didn't happen after they were shot. Not a single one of them vaporized. Not a single one of them, like, disappeared and fell into the fourth dimension. None of them exploded. Bloom! Like you see in a lot of television shows, especially anything that's done by that great disaster guy who's doing 2012. None of them were picked up and thrown through walls or shattered brick walls or thrown off the ground. Oh, God, none of those things actually happen to people when they're shot. What happened to people when they're shot? Well, sometimes they keep shooting back. They keep shooting back. And that's a critical point. I mean, the one that stood out, and I can't remember the details because it's a long time ago, was a perpetrator who had, I believe a biker, who'd been shot by the police with 12-gauge slugs, I think more than five times. And I think two or three of those hits were fatal hits. But he kept moving and kept returning fire. Now, that's interesting. That's interesting. Because when we look at one-shot stop theories, we look at the concept of stopping power, what it says is the energy is, you know, let's assume that a definition of stopping power is the energy inherent in the bullet, mass, velocity of the bullet, carries enough power to cause a person to do X, stop what they're doing. And that's not realistic. Those of you who are hunters and have been in the field, you already know it's not realistic. I personally have seen a very small white-tailed deer shot across the shoulders with a .264 Winchester mag. You have one of the belted magnum cartridges with a nozzle, I think a 270 grain, some, or a heavy nozzler partition bullet. Across the shoulder, shatters the lung, shatters the shoulder. The deer ran for, oh, I don't know, 300, 400 yards before it collapsed and died. That was a long period of time. Now, the deer didn't realize it was dead. The deer didn't realize it was dead. It didn't realize that its shoulders were shattered. It didn't realize there was no way for it to run. It just kept running. So hunters are, you know, and that's not, you know, that's a personal story of mine, but, you know, I've never met a hunter who didn't have that kind of story about the game they shot. So why should that not also be true for people? The different factor with people is that we have expectations based on what we think we know. So, say, like those of us in the gun cultures who are real 45 caliber people, like, whoa, man, I believe in the 45, I believe the 45 ACP, the most powerful cartridge on earth. Somebody points a gun at you and pulls the trigger, it's a 45 ACP, it's a 1911, you instantly recognize it and you go, holy cow, I'm about to be hit by the most powerful handgun cartridge one. What happens to you? Well, I would suggest that you probably overreact, because what you've done is you've inadvertently programmed your body to react to a hit by something that you in your own mind are convinced is just short of Obi-Wan Kenobi's lightsaber. Interesting, isn't it? Now, criminals don't do that. Criminals program themselves the other way. You know, we've talked a lot about violent criminal actors, and that's what I'm talking about here. I'm talking about professional criminals. I'm talking about the top of the food chain. I am not talking about Joe Bob Junkie. But there's a trickle down to this. So part of it is the criminals program themselves the other way, because criminals know things about their job. Crime is their job, and that job has a job description. One of the points of that job description, and I'm stealing this wholesale from my mentor, Walt Rausch, the author of The Real World, What's Work for Me, certainly one of the founders of USPSA, one of the founders of IDPA, one of the founders of the National Tactical Invitational, one of the most thoughtful men in the business. And what Walt says is part of that criminal job description is having a gun pointing at you. Criminals get guns pointed at them. I've had a gun pointed at me, and I wanted to wet myself. Oh, my God, I've been shot at. and my initial response was to curl up like a baby and cry. It sucked. But Gunn pointed at me. Oh, my insides go, as they say, watery. You kind of feel your bowels go soft. You're going like, oh, look at the hole in that gun. Criminals don't react that way because it's part of their job description. You know, you want to go out and be an armed robber, somebody's going to point a gun at you. But here's the other thing that criminals know that we don't. Criminals know that most people don't shoot, even if they have a gun. Most people are not going to shoot, very likely. That, or at least that's been the case until the widespread proliferation of concealed carry. But previously, people didn't shoot. Secondly, here's the second thing criminals know. In a gunfight, most of the shots miss. How many times have you got up and read about a law enforcement gunfight in the newspaper, and you're going like, all those rounds fired and not many hit? Interesting. I mean, whether it's the OK Corral or something that happened last week. A lot of rounds fired, very few hits. Third thing that criminals know that we don't know is that most people who get shot recover. Most people who are shot by handgun cartridges, and I've seen stats as high as 85 to 87%, recover. So think about adding that up. Now, if you're a violent criminal actor, you're a professional criminal actor, add all that up. Well, they're probably not going to shoot, and if they do shoot, they're probably going to miss. If they do hit me, nothing's going to happen, and if I die, I could get hit by a bus today. When you start adding up all those most, they're not going to fire. If they do fire, they're going to miss. If they do hit me, it's not going to kill me. From a criminal standpoint, the equation adds up well. On the criminal side of the ledger, they feel pretty good about it. The difference between them and you is that the armed criminal, the criminal that has a gun, he's going to pull a trigger. Why? Because he knows. He knows there's always that chance. It's important to him to pull the trigger before you pull the trigger. Interesting, isn't it? Think about that in terms of expectations. A criminal's expectations is you're going to miss, and if you do hit him, big deal. He has friends who've been shot. If you're in a criminal subculture, you know people who have been shot. And again, they didn't vaporize, they didn't blow up, they didn't explode, they weren't picked up, thrown through a concrete block wall. Instead, they went, oh, darn, oh, crap, oh, expletive deleted, went to the emergency room, got patched out, and went back out. Did business or dealt revenge. So especially within a gang culture, within a criminal culture, they know people who have been shot and injured and nothing happened. Sure, they know people who were killed, but not that many. Not that many. But we don't know that. So we program in those expectations. And the reason I bring it up is that I know we've talked about this before, but I mean, this is an important mindset for you as an armed civilian, which is there's no such thing as a one-shot stop. Don't think that. And the reason you don't want to think one-shot stop is what if it makes you fire one shot and hesitate just for that second? Well, I fired one shot, it's 45 ACP, damn, you know, if it was a Velociraptor, it should be lying on the ground screaming like a baby. Hesitation equals death. Got that? Hesitation equals death. If you hesitate, you're lost. You're lost. You give the criminal a chance to respond. So if you're thinking, this is the most powerful, you know, let's do the Dirty Harry thing, most powerful handgun on earth, down, blow your head, plumb off, da-da-da-da-da, you feel lucky, punk. It still might not work. If multiple shotgun slugs didn't take an individual down, dang, dead, bang, wham, meat on the ground, then what makes you think your handgun's going to work 100%? One-shot stop thinking is dangerous. Instead, you think, I got to shoot until the threat stops. That means multiple shots. And we talked about that in relationship with mouse guns, right? Any caliber less than 9mm. Assume multiple shots, bang, 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 bang. Remember that? At least three shots and a failure drill. That is a headshot. So remember that? We talked about that? I think that if you're carrying a gun for self-defense, you have to think in terms of multiple shots, in terms of making sure the threat is ended. And that means making profoundly sure the threat is ended. Didn't you see Carrie? Didn't you see every other horror show that ever followed Carrie? Just when you put the thing in the ground, the next thing you know, a great big hand comes up and grabs you and pulls you down with it. You can't think about one-shot stops. Instead, you have to think about, I need to end the threat. The most efficient way to end the threat is multiple shots. Bang, bang, or bang, 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 or bang, 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 bang. You know, if a guy's coming towards you and he's got a shotgun and he's lowering that shotgun towards you, it's going to be bang, 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 bang. Because I need to stop the threat before the threat is brought to bear on me. So any kind of thinking about a one-shot stop, that's why that kind of thinking potentially produces a hesitation that potentially can be deadly. So you want to get away from that kind of thinking. You don't know how many shots it's going to take to end it, but the more threat you're facing, the more rounds you need to put down range to make sure the threat ends. If you go bang, wow, that was a center mass hit, bang, that guy should die. He might die, but he might shoot you back before he dies. That means the threat is not ended. You haven't ended the threat. I'm going to use a line here from John Farnham. It probably hates me using this line. But in one of John Farnham's classes, you're talking about what happens when people are shot. And one of the things he said is, John said, what happens if you're shot in the forehead? The shot enters your forehead into the cerebellum. Because does that mean you stop instantly? The answer is no. As John said, and this is cold, but true, he goes, you're shot in the cerebellum. You may not get all the jokes, but you can still return fire. That's the key point here, folks. If we've shot someone and they can still return fire, the threat is ended. If we pull the trigger, bang, and hesitate for a second, we could get shot back. Or if we double tap, bang, bang, we've trained ourselves to double tap, bang, bang, let's assess. I don't know. Even that, any hesitation there, you want to make sure that the threat is down. The threat is down. The gun is on the ground. Obviously, you're giving verbal commands in here. We're not going to get into that today. You know, but you're drop the gun, stops, drop the gun, freeze. You know, whatever phraseology you've chosen that you think works the best. But anyway, don't spend as much time thinking about stopping power as you need to spend thinking about multiple shots. And again, from Rob Pincus from ICE Training, ICE, and he hates me calling it ICE Training too, ICE, integrity, consistency, whatever. Rob, I had a brain freeze there. But however many shots it takes to put down the threat, so in your training, do not sequence yourself to fire one shot, evaluate, or to fire two shots and evaluate. Mix it up. Bang, 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 bang. You're always thinking the threat has to be stopped. If the threat has a weapon, the weapon needs to be on the ground. If the threat doesn't drop the weapon, then the threat and the weapon need to be on the ground. You need to think about those kind of things in your training. So anyhow, again, we're running a little short here, which is good. For today, it's Thursday. So I'm going to go ahead and having given you that to think about. So, you know, we're not going to be bowing, and we're going to go out and buy like some kind of cool 16-inch battle rifle. And we're also going to think about how many shots we do in our training this week. That's what we're going to do. When you go out and train, mix it up a little. Be sure to mix it up a little. And that's especially important for you competition shooters, or for us competition shooters, of which I am one. Is basically the competition tells us what it wants us to do. USPSA competition, for example, mostly mandates double taps. IDPA competition, a little bit different, a little bit maybe based on a more real type scoring system, but still typically you're going to be firing double taps. A lot of really good match directors, and John May, who is always the match director for the USPSA Nationals, knows really how to mix it up. But you fall into a sequence of double tap, or even double tap, triple tap, or failure, double tap, failure drill, shot to the head. You fall into patterns based on the competition that you shoot. I shoot a lot of cowboy action shooting. That means one shot on a steel target. Bing! You got to get beyond that in your own practice. Competition is great. Don't get me wrong. You know what a fan I am of competition. That false pressure created by the timer inoculates you against greater pressure in the real world. But you always have to get beyond your competition, and your training needs to get beyond your competition. You're a hardcore competition shooter. There are days you need to go out and practice for training purposes. You need to take training classes. I like that. You know, you're a competition shooter, so go to Gunsight. You know, take the Gunsight 250 basic class and set aside what you know for competition. Regardless of the competition you're in, set that aside for the class and focus on the drills that they teach you, because those drills will keep you safe. I promised you another golden oldie, didn't I? Okay, we heard some Euro Trash Girl from Cracker. Now let's cue up Roger Klein and the Peacemakers, also known as the Arizona Peacemakers, a Tempe, Arizona rock band, and their version of Bandidos. I love that song. How can you not love that song? I got the pistol, so I get the pesos. So, hey, that seems fair. Oh, gosh. Again, an abbreviated version today. We'll be back to normal next week. On the day before Turkey Day, we might have some recipes for you, for those of you looking for something to cook. In the meantime, I am your host, Michael Bain, here on Downrange Radio, powered by the Outdoor Channel. And regardless of whatever gun you're carrying while you're out turkey hunting this week for Thanksgiving, you stay safe out there.